Welcome back, everyone. We're diving into the world of flame-retardant materials used in injection molding today.
Fascinating topic.
I know, right? It's one of those things we don't often think about, but...
It's everywhere.
Yeah, it is everywhere in our electronics. You sent us some excerpts from a product designer's article, and I have to say...
It's a good one.
Yeah, it's really interesting how they break it down, and it got me thinking, you're designing, say, like the latest gadget, right? It needs to be sleek, functional, and obviously safe.
Of course, safety is paramount.
And that's where these materials come in.
It's a critical consideration.
But the choices can be pretty overwhelming.
Absolutely. The sheer variety of flame retardants available can make your head spin if you're not careful.
Exactly. So today, we're going to unpack all of that. The science behind how they work, the challenges they present, and even some future trends that are shaping the electronics we use every single day.
What I find particularly interesting is that it's all about finding the right balance.
Balance between?
Between safety and functionality. You need a material that can withstand fire, of course, but it also has to meet all the performance requirements of that specific product.
Right. So, like, I don't know, the material for a phone case has to be...
Impact resistant.
Exactly. Oh. And it has to be, what, cost effective and environmentally responsible, too.
All those factors come into play. It's a real juggling act.
So let's start with the basics. What exactly are these flame retardant materials? I mean, we use electronics all the time.
All the time.
So they must be pretty important.
They are absolutely essential. You could say they're the silent guardians of our electronics, making sure things don't go up in flames.
Okay, that's a pretty dramatic way to put it.
Well, it's true. They're designed to either slow down or completely prevent the spread of fire.
Got it. But how do they actually, like, DO that?
They work in a few different ways. Some disrupt the chemical reactions that fuel a fire at a molecular level.
So they're interfering with the fire itself.
Precisely. Others create a physical barrier, like a char layer, to protect the material underneath from the flames.
Oh, that's interesting. So multiple approaches.
And then you have what we call synergists.
Synergists.
They boost the effectiveness of other flame retardants.
Oh, okay. So they work together.
Exactly. It's like a team effort. They might reduce smoke production, which is critical for visibility during a fire, or enhance the char layer formation.
I see. The article mentioned three main types: halogenated compounds, phosphorus-based additives, and nitrogen-based synergists. Are those the big players?
Those are the ones you'll encounter most often.
And each one has its own strengths and weaknesses, I imagine.
Exactly. Halogenated compounds, for example, were the go-to for years. They're highly effective, relatively inexpensive.
Sounds good so far.
But there are growing concerns about their environmental impact.
Okay, that makes sense. What about those phosphorus-based additives?
Those are becoming increasingly popular. Instead of disrupting the chemical reaction, they form a protective layer on the material's surface.
Like a shield.
Exactly. A fire-resistant shield, generally considered more environmentally friendly.
That's good.
But they can be a bit pricier.
So there's a trade-off there.
Always a trade-off. And then you have your nitrogen-based synergists, often working behind the scenes, enhancing the other flame retardants.
Fascinating. So much to consider I hadn't realized.
You're right. It's more than just picking something that won't catch fire.
Right, right. The article also mentioned how these flame retardants impact the mechanical properties of the final molded part. What are some of the key things to watch out for there?
Think of it this way. Adding a flame retardant is kind of like trying to build a house out of slightly weaker bricks.
Okay, I get the analogy.
You might compromise some of the material's structural integrity.
So it could be less durable.
You could see a decrease in tensile strength, for example.
Yeah.
That means the material might be more prone to tearing under stress.
Oh, I see. What else?
You could also see a reduction in elasticity, making it more brittle and susceptible to cracking.
So it's a balancing act. You want it to be fire resistant, but not at the expense of basic functionality.
Precisely. It's about finding that sweet spot. The article highlighted a case study where intumescent additives were combined with mineral fillers to improve both fire resistance and structural integrity.
I'm intrigued. How does that work?
Well, intumescent additives react to heat by swelling up, forming this thick insulating layer.
So it's almost like a built-in fire extinguisher.
Exactly. And then the mineral fillers add strength and rigidity.
It's like reinforcing those weaker bricks we talked about.
Precisely. It's a clever solution.
It really is. Now, let's talk about electronics specifically. What are some of the unique considerations when choosing materials for devices like, I don't know, our phones and laptops?
Well, first and foremost, compliance with safety standards is crucial.
Right. You want to make sure it meets all the regulations.
Exactly. There are standards like UL94, which set the minimum requirements for materials used in electronics.
So it's like a seal of approval, making sure it's safe for consumers.
Exactly. And then you have to factor in thermal stability.
Oh, right, because electronics generate heat.
They do, and that heat can affect the material over time. The chosen material has to withstand those temperatures without degrading or affecting the performance.
Right. You don't want your phone melting in your hand.
Exactly. Then there are the electrical properties to consider. You need good insulation to prevent electrical shorts.
Makes sense.
If the casing of your device isn't properly insulated, it can lead to malfunctions or even pose a safety risk.
Okay, that's definitely something to think about. And what about the environmental impact of all these materials? Is that a major concern?
It's becoming a top priority for both consumers and manufacturers.
And rightfully so.
There's a big push for eco-friendly options, and companies are exploring alternatives to some of the traditional flame retardants that might have questionable environmental and health profiles.
It's a complex issue.
It is. There's a lot to consider.
We've definitely only just scratched the surface here, but it's already clear that there's a lot more to this than meets the eye.
There's a whole world of hidden science at work in the devices we use every day.
Yeah.
And it's constantly evolving.
Exactly. So in the next part of our deep dive, we're going to take a closer look at those environmental and health impacts, and we'll explore how the industry is searching for safer, more sustainable solutions for the future.
Stay tuned. It's going to be a fascinating discussion.
We've been talking about the science behind these flame retardant materials and the choices that designers have to make, but it's clear that there are these bigger implications, right?
Absolutely. It's not just about preventing a fire in your living room. We have to think about the impact on the environment, the potential risks to human health.
Right. And the article brought up some concerns about these materials building up in ecosystems. It specifically mentioned fish, and I think it used the term bioaccumulation.
Yeah, bioaccumulation. It sounds a bit scary, but it's a real phenomenon.
So what is it exactly? How does it work?
Well, think about it like this. You have these flame retardant chemicals, and they can end up in waterways, in rivers and lakes.
Right, okay.
And then tiny organisms, little creatures in the water, absorb these chemicals.
They just soak them up.
Essentially, yeah. And then bigger fish come along and eat those smaller organisms.
And the chemicals are passed along.
Exactly. And this continues up the food chain, so you end up with top predators like fish with much higher concentrations of these chemicals in their bodies.
So it's like a domino effect.
You could say that.
Yeah.
And it can have serious consequences. The article mentioned disruptions to fish reproductive systems, which is a big deal.
Yeah, that's not good.
It can impact the entire ecosystem. And we rely on healthy ecosystems, you know, for so many things.
Food, clean water, all of that.
Exactly. So disrupting that balance can have some pretty far-reaching effects.
Okay, so that's the environmental side of things. But what about human health? Are there risks to people who are, you know, just using everyday electronics?
There are some potential concerns there as well. The article talked about workers in manufacturing settings who handle these materials on a daily basis.
Right, so they're directly exposed.
Yeah, and for them, inhalation of dust particles is a primary risk.
So breathing in those tiny particles.
And that can lead to respiratory issues, irritation in the lungs, things like that.
Okay, so that makes sense. But what about the rest of us, people who aren't working in factories?
Well, these chemicals can end up in our homes, in dust, on surfaces. The level of exposure is likely much lower. But some studies have raised concerns about potential endocrine disruption.
Endocrine disruption? That sounds serious. What does that even mean?
It means that these chemicals can potentially interfere with our hormones.
Our hormones.
And hormones are incredibly important. They control all sorts of bodily functions.
So messing with that balance could have some pretty significant effects.
Exactly. The research is ongoing, but it's something to keep in mind.
It definitely seems like we need more transparency, more information about what's in our products and how it might affect us.
And there are steps being taken in that direction. The EU's REACH regulations, for instance, require companies to provide detailed information about the chemicals they use.
So more accountability.
Right. And here in the U.S., the EPA is also promoting the development of safer alternatives.
That's good to hear.
They're encouraging research into new materials and technologies that can provide that fire protection without those same risks.
So it's like we're at a crossroads, realizing that safety and sustainability need to go hand in hand.
It's a shift in thinking, and it's exciting to see the progress that's being made.
It is. We've talked about the why, the what, the impact, but how about the how?
The how.
How are these materials actually made? What goes into the manufacturing process?
That's a great question. And it turns out the manufacturing process itself has its own set of challenges, especially when it comes to injection molding.
Okay, so let's shift gears then and take a look at what happens on the factory floor. So we've talked about the science, the impact, all these big picture things, but let's get down to the nitty-gritty. How do they actually make these flame retardant products?
The manufacturing process. That's where the rubber meets the road.
And the article hinted that it's not exactly a walk in the park, especially when it comes to injection molding.
It's definitely not as simple as just, you know, mixing some magic powder into plastic and voila.
So what are some of the challenges? What do manufacturers have to wrestle with?
Well, the designer brought up moisture sensitivity as a major hurdle.
Moisture sensitivity, like it affected by humidity and stuff.
Exactly. A lot of these flame retardants are hygroscopic, meaning they absorb moisture from the air, like little sponges.
Oh, wow. And that's a problem because...
Well, for one thing, it can lead to hydrolysis. That's where the water actually reacts with the flame retardant and breaks it down.
So it weakens the fire protection.
Exactly. You're basically compromising the very thing you're trying to achieve.
Right.
And on top of that, excess moisture can mess with the molding process itself.
How so?
You can get imperfections in the final product, like little bubbles or voids.
So it weakens the material?
It can, yeah. Compromises the strength and integrity.
So how do manufacturers deal with that?
Lots of careful control. The article talked about pre-drying the materials before processing, getting rid of any existing moisture.
Makes sense.
And keeping the molding environment itself super dry. It's all about controlling the atmosphere.
So it was like a delicate dance.
Right.
What other challenges did they mention?
Thermal stability is another big one. And I'm not just talking about the final product's ability to withstand heat.
Right. You're talking about the manufacturing process itself.
Exactly. Injection molding involves high temperatures, and adding flame retardants can really change the melting point of the plastic, how it flows, all of that.
So it's not a one-size-fits-all approach.
Not at all. You need to fine-tune the process for each specific material, finding that sweet spot where everything works just right. Too high a temperature, you risk degrading the material. Too low, and it might not fill the mold properly.
It's all about precision.
It is.
It is.
And then there's the whole issue of compatibility. You can't just mix any flame retardant with any polymer and expect it to be a happy marriage.
Oh, right. Like oil and water.
Exactly. They need to be compatible. Otherwise, you might end up with a material that's weak, brittle, or just doesn't blend properly.
So how do you know if they'll get along?
Well, there are tests you can do to see how they interact under different conditions. It's all about finding the right recipe.
Sounds like a lot of trial and error.
There's definitely some of that involved. But experience helps. And then there's the issue of dispersion.
Dispersion.
Making sure the flame retardant is evenly distributed throughout the entire material. If it clumps up in certain spots, you're creating weak points, areas that are more vulnerable to fire.
Makes sense. So how do you ensure good dispersion?
Well, the article mentioned twin screw extrusion, which is a fancy way of saying they use these powerful machines to really mix the materials together thoroughly.
Like a super blender for plastics.
Exactly. And it's these kinds of innovations that are helping to overcome these challenges and create high-quality flame retardant materials.
It's amazing to think about all the science and engineering that goes into something we often take for granted. So what's next? What's the future hold for this field?
Well, the trend is definitely moving towards sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing more non-halogenated materials, nano-based additives, even bio-based options derived from plants. It's all about finding that balance, you know, between safety, performance, and responsibility.
It's a balancing act, but it sounds like we're headed in the right direction. This has been a fascinating look into the world of flame retardant materials. It's clear that they play a vital role in our safety, but the choices we make as consumers and manufacturers have a ripple effect. So the next time you pick up your phone, your laptop, any electronic device, take a moment to appreciate the hidden science at work and consider the impact those choices have on the world around us. Thanks for joining us, and until next time, keep exploring.